ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Für unseres Reiches Macht.
From Hitler's secret drug addiction to a wrong turn that started a world war, the past is littered with hidden stories of turning points that changed the world. I'm Mark Fennell, and it is my mission to find them and bring them to you each and every week. No One Saw It Coming is the podcast that will change how you think about history. Find it now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, with an armada at its door, Iran now seems ready to talk.
Donald Trump is applying maximum pressure, the only way he knows how. But what's going on inside the country as human rights groups seek to verify the deaths of tens of thousands of protesters?
Yes, the slaughter that's unfolded there last month makes Tiananmen Square seem tame. So how does Iran hold together after such horror? Where does its future lie?
I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Welcome to Global Roaming. Slowly, numbers have dawned on us, Latika, about what has been, it's sort of dribbling out of Iran. The details are dribbling out.
Day after day, we are hearing more and more horrific accounts of the barbarity inflicted upon them by the Islamic regime.
One woman who was at the protest told me that she watched security forces shoot her friend in the leg. She said that President Trump is their only hope and Iranians need help to overthrow the Islamic regime, which has shown no mercy for its own people.
Yes, now as we're recording this, according to an Iranian news agency, the president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has ordered the start of nuclear talks with the US. Now that is scheduled for Friday and that's really going to be something to keep our eye on. And we all know, of course, about the armada sitting there in the Persian Gulf sent by Donald Trump, a big floating threat. It is from the US, intended to pressure the regime. Now, I wonder what you've been trying to access yourself. Have you gleaned any more clarity?
Look, this is one of the most difficult conflicts to try and monitor, Geraldine, because we're all operating in this huge information gap, and that's deliberate. The Iranian regime has been brutal in cutting off communications, and not just internet services, but actual phone connections. So it's impossible for all the sources that you would normally be able to rely upon for this sort of information to know whether the information is accurate and at what scale the death is happening in Iran. I have to say I've been talking to some of my sources in Europe here, and even in the first week, Geraldine, they said to me when the death toll was estimated at around 1,000, they said, no, it's far more than that. We reckon about 5. I mean, that was in the first few days. So God only knows what it is going to be when we finally do get inside Iran or people are able to communicate outside.
Look, these things, you've got to read between the lines, you've got to join dots, you've got to discern what is said and not said and so on. It's a very, very difficult time, huge sort of pressure on journalists to try to be fair. What I've started to see, and, you know, it hasn't been there in Iran to the same extent, maybe after the Mahsa Amini protests a couple of years ago, there's a sort of a, I don't know what to call it. It is a fury. It's a turning. You know, what have we got to lose? And the Iranians are very nationalistic and they're actually very proud. Now, you push them beyond a certain point and, you know, they just could really turn on that regime. They could.
That is especially the balance that I've been trying to look at, Geraldine, as well. At what point does the scale of this crackdown, and it sounds just horrific and bloody at a scale we have not seen before, at what point does that tip people, either it further radicalizes them or it does crush them? It crushes their spirit. And we've seen that in Russia. Remember when the war in Ukraine began? There were some initial protests. We forget about that now. But now the society that was brutally cracked down upon is largely behind the special military operation in Ukraine. That is what I've been looking for in Iran. Is this going to be a real revolution where the people cannot be deterred? Or will the Iranians, with the tools of technology that authoritarian regimes now have, will they be successful in cutting them off?
I'm afraid that regime appears ready to shoot everybody. Like it just will keep shooting. Now, what do you do when you're in a situation like that?
I'm also waiting to see if the Trump administration will help them. I mean, we've heard all the noises, we've seen the armada, but we haven't seen much action, have we?
Not yet, but they're all there, all those destroyers, all those F-15s and so on. And now, look, to help us understand more is Holly Dargrus. She is Iranian-American. She spent her teenage years living in Iran. She's now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute's program on Iran and US policy. She curates a widely read weekly newsletter on Iran. It's called The Iranist. And she has a particular interest in Gen Z inside Iran. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Holly to Global Roaming. Holly Dargrus, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me. It's an honour.
We hear that it's pretty febrile inside Iran at the moment, but it's so hard to be sure. As someone who's observed it for years and knows it, what's your judgment?
Well, I think the situation's dire. We had an, I would say, unprecedented massacre, probably the worst massacre in Iranian history. We haven't seen numbers like that since the late 1790s. And so the numbers that have been shared so far from groups like human rights activists in Iran, that's being heavily cited in the media and also by the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Human Rights, these numbers are what's really on the minds of Iranians.
So Holly, what is your assessment of the death toll figures? Because some sources I've been talking to have said the official numbers we're seeing are far, far, far lower than what they think they actually are. What is your assessment of the numbers?
So to start with, Iranian officials, I think, are saying about 2,000 to 3,000. We all are saying, okay, if that's the number they're giving, it must be much higher, double, triple at least, at the very minimum. The group Human Rights Activists in Iran, which is heavily cited by the media and I respect deeply and I use their work and I talk to because they actually have people on the ground, I think was saying about a little over 6,000 have been documented. They're now reviewing about roughly around 12,000 additional. So they're actually having to verify with families and forensics and all that stuff. So it's pretty high. And then you have the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights that's saying it could be as high as 20,000. And of course, it was, we believe, between January 8th and 9th that these massacres occurred. And it was tied to a call by a former Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, who said, told Iranians that on January 8th and 9th to take to the streets. They were already protesting, of course, since December 28th, but it was really, I would argue, that call and, of course, Trump's support of the Iranian protesters through his Truth Social post and, of course, some of his commentary in media that really made Iranians think that they have the backing of the United States in this moment where they're trying to fight for freedom and basically and oust the Islamic Republic.
So you're seeing it as a bit of a tipping point. Like, how many times has this been posed and it doesn't turn out to be like that and the regime is still there? So I'm just, are you trying to discern that yourself?
I would say that they've crossed the threshold of no return. We've had cyclical anti-regime protests for years, most famously being the 2022 Women Life Freedom Uprising, which unfortunately, according to the UN fact-finding mission, crimes against humanity were also committed then. We believe right now we're seeing the same atrocities were committed, if not worse, especially the scale that's unprecedented. A lot has changed since 2022. We're now living in the post-October 7th world dynamics, and that's heavily impacted the place of the Islamic Republic in the region. So on a foreign policy front, and I'll unpack that. So you've seen that its regional proxies have been maimed in Lebanon, in the Gaza Strip, and of course its top ally, Bashar al-Assad in Syria, has been toppled. And then we saw that with the 12-day war, that it was unable to defend its airspace and that its nuclear program's in shambles. Not obliterated, but it's definitely not in the state it was. So from a foreign policy perspective, it's in dire straits. On a domestic front, you're dealing with historically high anti-regime sentiment that's been going on for years now. You're dealing with a country with systemic mismanagement and corruption that's not being addressed. Iranians are struggling to get by financially. And of course, this is a resource-rich country. Why is it having power outages? So I think that on those two fronts, it's in a real delicate situation. And Jack Goldstone, who's an expert on revolutions and social uprisings, and a fellow Iran expert, Karim Sajapour at the Carnegie Institute for Peace, wrote a great article in The Atlantic in January saying that for the first time since 1979, the Islamic Republic has checked all boxes for collapse. So that's why I think that this time around, things are different. It doesn't mean that the regime's about to leave just yet, but I think it's on its way out. And that timeline is the one part I'm not entirely sure how long it'll take.
Holly, do we know anything about what types of people are protesting, how broad across Iranian society it is, and whether that's different to previous protests and uprisings?
So this is the second time we've seen all 31 provinces of Iran light up, the first, of course, being the 2022 Woman Life Freedom Uprising. Just like in 2022, I would argue that this was a Gen Z-led protest. So it's young Iranians that are taking to the streets. And it's because they want to take a hold of their future. They were born in a country where they didn't get to decide who was their leadership. They are the first to be born with internet and social media at their fingertips. And they see how the rest of the world lives. And they want that. And so that is really what you're seeing here. But I think it's also noteworthy, and people haven't been talking about this much in the news, is that initially pro-regime Iranians were also protesting. And they were protesting because of the economy, and they were very unhappy. And that's why you saw, at least in the first few days, the government of Masoud Pezeshkian, the president, was trying to figure out a way on the economic front, in almost an insulting way, offering the equivalent of $7 to help improve the lives of Iranians. And just for listeners, just for context, this protest was prompted by the sudden collapse of the Iranian rial against the US dollar. And then, of course, it snowballed into this vehemently anti-regime protest that we've seen capture the world headlines.
Do we know anything different or new about the methods of crackdown that the regime is imposing upon the protesters? Is that different to the uprisings of past?
What I would say was the volume of death and destruction as news came out of the country. You have to remember there's a communication shutdown, so we were relying on Starlink. There's about 50 to 60,000 users that have smuggled in Starlink terminals. But in terms of repression tactics, because of the volume, like, people were describing it as being a war zone, that they had run out of blood transfusion at hospitals, that body bags were hard to come by. At Tehran's largest cemetery, which houses more than a million dead, known as Behesht-e Zahra, or Zahra's Paradise, things were so bad that they started handing burial plots and body bags and burial shrouds for free. And then, of course, there's been these horrifying testimonies about how you might have seen that there is over, according to the group Human Rights Activists in Iran, like at 200 plus dead security forces. Well, we're being told that in order to hand over the bodies of slain protesters to their families, they're having to sign papers or even pay exuberant amounts of money saying that they were actually members of the security forces.
Given all this, which is very hard to hear, you know, it is an extraordinary to think of people being slaughtered on this scale, The talks that are now appear to be planned for Turkey at the end of the week. So I think the Iranian foreign minister has basically said, we're always been ready for talks. We just want respect at those talks, whatever that means. And it would appear that Steve Witkoff, President Trump's personal representative, is going to meet him at the end of the week. They're described as nuclear talks that both go to the question of Iran's nuclear enrichment capability and its ballistic missile capability. However, we also hear that the region itself, the Saudis, the Emiratis, are adamant. There's hectic diplomacy underway about them saying, we do not wish to be the staging post for any activity that could come from the armada, for instance, the naval armada that's gathered. So look, these are very conflicting signals, I think. Do you believe the talks will go ahead?
There's definitely a real worry from regional allies of the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, were chief concern, expressed chief concern in recent weeks. You may have read that, I think it was on January 14th, that they actually almost did do an attack. And it was actually those three countries that were like, whoa, wait a minute, you don't have assets in the region. We don't have, like, who's going to defend our airspace? Because, of course, as we've seen with the 12-day war, Iran does retaliate. It does fire ballistic missiles and drones. And so there was a real worry that they wouldn't have U.S. assets in the region to defend these respective countries.
So the fear was about themselves being caught up in the crossfire, not so much about the instability of the regime's collapse and what that would do, or was it a bit of both?
I would say it's a bit of both. I was in the region in December in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, and there was a real expressed concern about what regime collapse would look like, because what would take hold afterwards. And I think it's important to emphasize these same countries were actually in support of the first Trump administration's maximum pressure policy and were actually very keen on ousting the Islamic Republic. So this 180 is very interesting and noteworthy. And I want to unpack that just a little bit. And it really comes down to the economic visions of these respective countries, especially countries like Saudi Arabia that have a Vision 2030 project. They're very much worried about their own investments. Like, let's say these American and Western companies that are investing in Saudi Arabia as part of this 2030 project, and the possibility that another regional war would break out or ballistic missiles are fired into their territory would really create problems for Saudi Arabia, for example, and its project. And so their view of these conflicts is that it's a big headache and it's going to hurt the pockets of our countries and our people.
So where does that leave us then? If the economist is right that there's growing rage inside the country, not fear, if this is correct, this is going to spill over into the region, isn't it? There's no stopping it.
I mean, I definitely agree with that assessment. There is, just to give you a sliver of how that rage continues, Iranians, when they mourn, they very much express themselves and cry. And what I've seen are these extraordinary videos of Iranians dancing, celebrating the deaths of their loved ones, some giving weddings for their loved ones because they won't actually be able to have an actual wedding. And that to me signals that this is a people that is no longer afraid of its regime.
So the scale of those deaths, Holly, that you talked about, that is not deterring Iranians from protesting.
This is an act of protest, a celebration. It doesn't mean that you see people out in groups right now necessarily, but the fact that they're gathering, and by the way, a lot of these funerals are actually heavily securitized, but the fact that they're chanting anti-regime chants, that they're dancing, these are all, I would say, their way of basically flipping the bird at the Islamic Republic and saying, I'm not scared of you. I'm not going to stand down. You've killed my brother, my sister, my husband. I've seen a heartbreaking video or picture of this woman just kissing her husband for the last time. And so the trust has been lost for a long time, but it's been permanently broken.
So this is not just, this is beyond Tehran. This is in Mashhad and Isfahan and places like that.
All over the country, all 31 provinces has had people that have lost their lives, and mostly young, accomplished, beautiful people. And if they're not dead, they're being systemically shot in the eye to maim them so that they can send a message to other people in the future, which is exactly what happened during the 2022 uprising. And so just going back to what we're saying, this is a people that won't stand down, especially after this massacre. And I think that's why it's so problematic that the United States is talking about nuclear talks or any kind of negotiations at this juncture, especially since the president had openly told these protesters that the United States is going to come save them and that help is on the way and to take over your institutions. And it's a real insult to these people that have literally risked their lives for freedom for him to actually even entertain the idea to flirt with them. But, you know, this is also a president that also flirted back in spring. And then 3 days later, there was a 12-day war. So it's really hard to say what is really in the mind of the president. But if he does make a deal, he'll go into the history books, at least the Iranian history books, as being the worst U.S. president in history, worse than Jimmy Carter during the 1979 revolution, and worse than President Barack Obama, who decided to remain silent during the 2009 post-election protest known as the Green Movement, despite the fact that people were chanting at the time, "Obama, you're either with us or with them," them being the Islamic Republic.
Holly, is there any prospect of a transition if it's not collapse? Can the US facilitate a transition of the regime in any way? And is that likely at all?
This is a regime that's not going to go without a fight. That being said, I think the international community should be calling for democratic transition. It's what prominent activists on the ground like Nobel laureate Narges Mohammadi and 17 others had signed saying that they wanted something like that. And actually, I have to commend the Australian government for being, I think, one of the only to actually voice that there should be a democratic transition in Iran. And I think there should be more calls from that because that's literally what the streets are asking for. And so at least calling it and bringing it to the level of the UN, I think, is noteworthy. It doesn't mean it's necessarily going to succeed, but it means that you're paying attention, that you're not going to stand for these atrocity crimes that have been committed.
Holly, final question. Given that what you're suggesting still, to me, portends chaos, massive chaos, is it not probable that under this sort of pressure, somebody in the military, some general, decides that for the sake of his country, he puts his hand up and he emerges as a sort of a new, different type of dictator just to keep the country together? Because there's just immense risks for Iran in what you're describing.
There's always this possibility that a member of, for example, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which Australia just designated as a terrorist organization in recent months, would basically put on a suit, wrap himself in the flag of Iranian nationalism. And just handing the reins off to somebody that's a different face of the regime doesn't mean that the problems that have existed for decades, which is systemic mismanagement, repression, and corruption, are going to go away. And I think that's the issue here. Just because maybe the United States or Europe or the West as a whole would be more willing to deal with them doesn't mean that those problems at home will go away.
Well, Holly, there will be a lot, I think, unfold in the next little while. I don't know how long, but we'll all watch with sort of bated breath. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gosh, Geraldine, a lot of that was very hard to hear.
Yes, particularly the material around the celebrations around the coffins. I found really terribly affecting and sort of believable about what might be underway. And you know, she's discerning it from a distance like so many people are. There are so many gaps in what we understand, but it is starting to emerge. And I suppose the question is that we're all wondering is how much has that armada assisted this? Well, she says they absolutely did hear Trump saying they were coming to rescue and cause Reza Pahlavi. It's just because there are some other people who say that in terms of trying to look at how sustainable this protest movement is, that this has turned a lot of people off and they'll just retreat and they won't come out for another several years. It's very difficult to be sure, isn't it?
I found the line that resonated for me so much in that was when she said that protesters felt like it was an insult, what Trump had done, telling them to go out and protest, that America was coming to the rescue. It was a bit of an echo of the America of old that we remembered, the pre-Trump America, Geraldine, the America that did care about human rights and democratic movements and ending terrible regimes. And then the entire letdown, the word she didn't use, but it kept coming up in my mind, was betrayal. It felt and it looks and sounds like an absolute betrayal of the thousands of people who have died. And as you were saying, we're talking in gaps here. We actually don't even know yet the numbers of those slaughtered. It is terrifying to me, horrifying, when we do finally get a lift of the communication blackout, just what we'll find and uncover that's taken place in Iran.
I fear you're absolutely right. But it still remains true, notwithstanding all that, that if the rest of the world isn't prepared to go to war over it, and I don't want them to, by the way, the Iranian people have got to do this themselves. And that's the argument, is that they are.
They do, but there's a difference between being encouraged out on the streets because help is on its way, and then the help chicken's out, isn't there?
Look, this is why if they do manage to provoke negotiations at the end of the week, that, of course, will be with the regime. That's the same people who did the gunning down, and there's no evidence that they won't gun down again. But it's also what I've seen all through, and she alluded to this too, is the worry about chaos on the streets of Iran, a la chaos in Libya, parts of Syria, Afghanistan. From what I've read, that is an acute, very conscious fear inside Iran. Quite where that leaves you is very difficult.
And the wider region, Geraldine. You know, one of the reasons I'm so gloomy about this compared to Trump's other interventions, including in Iran earlier last year, is because if you look at when they have had great success, it's been when they go in and get the leadership. So Venezuela, why was that such a success for them? Because they got Maduro, got him out, and now they have an ability to install something in Venezuela that is more in the fashion or in their mold. By hesitating when they did in Iran, I really worry that now the leadership can fortify itself, hide, cower, solidify. And where is Trump? Look at Ukraine talks. We're still a year on. He said he'd finish that war in a day. Is this going to be the same outcome in Iran?
Yeah, well, we just don't know. I wouldn't be comfortable if I were Ayatollah Khamenei, but apparently he's hiding now. But then we also know the Israelis are in there penetrating the entire place, so I bet they do know where he is. I don't think it's over yet. Trump's decision-making is not over yet. Look, still so many questions and so much to be revealed. And I said last week we did this, Latika, and we would be back, and I think we will be again. Perhaps you have questions for us. You can always get in touch. We're very much enjoying, now that we've sort of formally issued even more invitation to you, to let us know what you'd like to focus on. global.roaming@abc.net.au. Now, tomorrow, Latika and Kylie are taking the reins, and you're talking about Sudan. Latika.
Once again, you'll be very happy with us, Geraldine.
Yes.
Two times in 2 weeks. It's not a bad strike rate.
No, it's very good. So another great show for you at 11 a.m. on RN, or search Global Roaming in the ABC Listen. Thanks for your company today, and thanks to our producers, Kylie Morris and Shane Anderson. Bye-bye, Latika.
Bye, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.